Hello, everybody. This is Jeremy Swenson, and we are sitting in a convention center hall at the Minneapolis Convention Center after the BurCon Cybersecurity Conference here on the 7th of June. It's a hot day, probably 83, maybe 84. And we are about to have an interesting conversation with a very famous thought leader, somebody by the name of Chris Roberts, who has just been really doing great things in cybersecurity, aviation security, and related concepts. And we have my guest from an identity and access management perspective, Mamadi Kuna here. Mamadi, why don't you go ahead and just introduce yourself?
Sure. Well, my name is Mamadi Kuna. I have been in the security field for over 10 years now. And three of those years, I've been working in identity and access management. And I was fortunate enough that I had an opportunity to work for a police department. I was a police reserve officer. So I know that cyber and physical go together. So that's a little bit about me. I'm currently a senior identity and access management analyst.
Thanks so much for being here, Mamadi. And Chris, if you could just go ahead and give an introduction of yourself.
Yes, certainly. Chris Roberts, currently the chief security strategist over at Evo Networks, causing chaos and mayhem, obviously, in the detection and the detection deception side of the world. So I mean, most people have probably figured out who I am by this point. If they haven't, they can probably just Google myself in airplanes, let's be honest.
Exactly.
Chris, everyone knows you.
Yeah, it's either that or tasers. I think my name and tasers are now coming up more often these days.
Help me understand the tasers thing.
I think it's a demonstration of frustration, shall we say, without actually shooting or kneecapping somebody. I figure it's a little bit less, you know, drastic. It's a little more recoverable from. Uh-huh. And, you know, the nice thing about tasering is you can actually share it with a friend if you get two people to hold hands together.
Exactly. And did they pull a taser on you at the airport when you flew in here?
No. I'm very fortunate that for the most part, I get to fly relatively, on the carriers I can fly, I get to fly relatively stress-free.
Oh, that's good. That's very good.
That is amazing. Well, we here at Abstract Forward, we support the BurCon conference. Really what it is the security community getting together for free without sales influence to collaborate and to share knowledge. Why don't you just give us a summary of your talk and your impression of this year's event, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, BurCon's, it's interesting. So Chris Payne and the fantastic team that he has around them have put, so Chris is the originator of the GurCon conference over in Grand Rapids. Mm. And then Chris ended up moving out here for a while and ended up starting up BurCon. I think this is number three or number four, and I've lost track these days. Mm-hmm. And so he started this one up, and it's the same kind of concept, which is bring in his friends and colleagues, which is, you know, the likes of the lunatics like us, as well as bring in a lot of students and mm-hmm. the businesses at the same time. So you get an entire mix of you know, demographics and everything, which is fantastic because from our standpoint, we get to get asked a lot of questions by people coming into the industry, sure, as well as people who are already here. So you get this amazing like melting pot of knowledge, mm-hmm, and just thoughts and views. To your point, you know, it's put on, in this case with BurCon, Target has obviously shouldered a chunk of the cost, as have a couple of others. And huge kudos and huge credit to that crew, definitely, for doing that. And, you know, everybody gets to come in, everybody gets to hang out. We spend an entire day just talking about security stuff, safety stuff, and trying to teach people. There are like three or four classes here as well that were just out there to try to train people.
Well, the one thing that I like about conferences like BurCon, and I've gone to it before, and Mamadi and I have gone to many security conferences, but the one thing I like about this one is you can say things and experiment in a way that you couldn't do at a large corporate bureaucracy like Mamadi and I have experience at banks and insurance companies, and we know there's some things that we would like to say, but we can't say or we can't even hear until we come to a conference like this and hear from someone like you or the other thought-leading speakers that they have. But the theme of your talk was security awareness through the eyes of a Great Dane. What does that mean to you?
It was a very different talk for me. I'm very well known, obviously, for breaking all sorts of interesting things, including humans, and looking to fix them as well. So, you know, you come in, you break it, and you try to help people explain how to fix it. Well, the talk today was very much more focused on us as humans. And, you know, the challenges that we are having in this industry, you know, the burnout issues, the challenges from a mental health standpoint. And really, it was designed as a wake-up call. And it came from very personal experiences. You know, the whole Great Dane thing is, you know, we took on rescue Danes. And we've had two of them over the last year. And, you know, we still have both of them. And it was looking at how I've changed, how my thoughts have changed through looking at how the analysis is with the dogs. And, you know, also just honestly taking care of myself more. And then looking at the industry and going, we're all in this together. How can we all try to help take care of each other?
Sure. So Chris, I would like to ask you a follow-up question on that. I know if you take any organization, there are people, processes, and technologies. And most often, based on my experience, companies focus on technologies and processes, and to forget the most important piece, which is people. So when you say breaking down people, like, what does that entail? Is it like training? Is it...
It's a number of things, and you're absolutely right. But I think there's a, I hope, let me rephrase this. I've seen a change in the trend, especially in our industry, because, I mean, there is definitely this perception that we don't have enough people around. And so HR and companies are being forced to look at the humans as almost that asset, and an almost irreplaceable asset to some degree. Now, that doesn't mean that we need to get big heads and go, ha-ha, we're irreplaceable, but it definitely means that we need to look after ourselves because we're becoming more valuable to companies. But the company hopefully is also paying attention to that. From my standpoint, it's very much almost a personal care. You know, you can typically only give your best if you're at your best.
That's good. That's absolutely.
And if we are not operating at full operating potential, then we're doing ourselves and everybody around us a disservice.
Now, there's a, like you say, back to your point, there's a series of security professionals nowadays. So as a result, if you take some organizations, a lot of work are put into security professionals. They work like crazy hours. So how do you find that medium where, okay, there are stories for security professionals and they have to get job done and there's nobody doing it? So how do you...
I think part of it is we almost have to become a little more selfish.
Okay.
I mean, you know as well as I do, and we all, everybody here and, you know, everybody at the conference almost is, I mean, I'm on 1 hour of sleep in the last 2.5 days.
Wow.
Yeah, I finished last night at about 2-ish, and the alarm went off at 3 o'clock to come out here.
Ow.
Yeah.
I don't know how you do it.
Yeah, and the previous tea. Good cup of strong Yorkshire Gold tea always works, kind of. Okay. But, and then the previous night, I got, you know, 3.5-4 hours. So I'm my own worst enemy, but at the same time, I recognize that I'll get back tonight, back to Colorado this evening. I'll crash. I'll take care of myself. I'll put my phone away. I won't touch it tomorrow. I won't touch my electronics tomorrow because guess what? Email's still going to be there.
That's right.
The world's still going to be around. Everybody's still going to, you know, and I'll keep an eye on things, but I'm not going to deal with anything unless I have to. And I think that's it. We've lost personal space. You know, when you wake up in the morning and the first thing you go for is your phone to check email, we're all in the same boat. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's the last thing you look at night and you pick it up during dinner. And yeah, we all know that. We all do it. I've turned around and said, look, I want to take care of myself. I've gone back to the gym again. My phone stays in the car. I don't touch the damn thing. It stays in the car. I have that hour to 2 hours.
Sure.
And I have my headphones on, and I use an iPod shuffle. I'm old school, not even Bluetooth connectivity.
Wow.
Yeah, deliberately, because I want to be completely isolated. And on Saturdays, I have my phone in case my daughter needs to get hold of me or Jen or anybody, but that's it, nothing else. No work, no nothing, unless, you know, the world is completely on fire, and it has to be me, and it can't be somebody else. Apart from that, guys, I love you dearly, but you can count me out for Saturdays.
Wow, that is a great analysis, and kind of reminds me of this concept of fire drill. It seems like there's always some type of fire drill, and a lot of times it's legitimate, but a lot of times it's not.
Right.
And how you navigate through that, and, you know, I get rush requests for these tasks that I have to work on, and everyone wants it now, and I say, well, you know, I need to take some time and do due diligence to research to move this forward. Otherwise, you make me rush, and I'm not at my best, like you're saying.
Yeah.
And then I might miss something because I'm not at my best. And you're totally on point with that. Reviewing the last 3 years, because I think 3 years is a good mark to see how technology has changed and how that can apply to security. In your mind, doing what you do, what do you think the biggest changes have been in the last 3 years?
Well, I mean, you talked about it with the identity and access management stuff. I mean, that's a huge concern, is not just actually, I mean, we spent 25 years talking about passwords and we've yet to figure it out. So that's one part. But the challenge now is we have such complex systems spread across so many different environments. Sure. We already own most of the passwords that everybody already uses. Mm-hmm. So the biggest one of the biggest challenges is actually validating that the person on the other end of that keyboard is the person you really want to let in. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest ones these days.
Yeah. And I would like to add to that, though, and that's actually one of the challenges that organization face in the IAM space, is like identity assurance. How do you know the guy who's sitting on the other side that he says who he is? And then access assurance, making sure that that guy has the proper access to do he or her job. And then we face, like, in organization that I work for, people are always moving from department to department. So how do you keep track of their access? Because there was a study done that 81% of data breaches are related to abuse privileges.
Credentials. Yeah. We run into, I mean, it's part of the reason, like on the deception side, that we're so hot on putting out credentials.
Sure.
Because if we put them, you know, in breadcrumbs, in the memory, in the browser, in the cache, and, you know, the 10 other places we can drop them, you know darn well the chances are if somebody starts using them, there's no legitimate reason for them to be used. So we found that to be very, very effective, which goes back to your point, which is, you know, if, as an attacker, you know, obviously one of my steps as an attacker is if I find creds, I need to validate them. I need to understand if they're any good, which in itself is starting to get dicey. And therefore, you know, and off I go. If I get good creds, I'll pivot, I'll move, and then I'm done. It's game over.
Yeah. And Chris, I would like to ask you a question about that, because in the IAM space right now, I'm not really sure about that, because there was a study done that a survey sent out to organization, medium, large, and they asked then about the IAM, you know, space. 26% of these organizations didn't know what was the PEM product. And 45% of these organizations didn't have a password vault. Also, that goes back to your point, is like, well, I mean, IAM is security 101. If you don't know who's coming to your house, you know, and who's leaving, you can have all the best tools in the world. Forget it.
Totally. So, it's it doesn't surprise me. And again, I think the challenge is, you know, we 20 odd years ago, adding an exclamation mark or an asterisk, you know, was kept everybody happy. It wasn't effective, but it kept everybody happy. And the problem is we haven't solved it. We've kept adding, you know, my analogy I always tend to use is we keep putting more and more Band-Aids on the problem. You know, 20 years ago, I told you had to put an asterisk. Then we gave you PCs, and I told you, you know, it had to be 8 characters because it got to the second hash that Microsoft had those days. And then if you're running an admin account, well, it had to be 15. Well, you know, then we had found ways around that one. And then, yeah, and we keep putting another Band-Aid on. Then we're like, okay, well, we'll put 2-factor in place. Oh, and we can send you SMS messages. Oh, yeah, we can spoof those. Oh, well, we'll do email. Oh, yeah, well, that's no. We don't have a solution.
One thing that's really a hot news item lately is this 3 billion or so fake Facebook IDs, which ties directly into IAM. I want to know what your take is on that, Chris. How do you think it happened, and what do you think an organization like Facebook can do to stop? This is a 5% of their user base, as I understood it.
Yeah.
3 billion.
We've got a database. I mean, there's a number of us that are sitting with a database outside of this country for all the obvious reasons. We've got 16 billion accounts in that database.
Wow.
So the likes of Have I Been Pwned, I think, is sitting at 4.5, 5.5 billion or 6 billion or whatever it is. We feed into their stuff. We've got 16 billion user accounts and emails.
Wow.
So, I mean, that 3 billion's a lot, no two ways about it. But, I mean, you think their user base is huge anyway. And it's likely to, I mean, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, I'll put my arm up. I mean, I've got numerous Facebook accounts. None of them are in my name.
Right.
So that was my point here. And I was talking about that was the biggest challenges on the internet is identification.
Yeah.
How do you know people can create a fake accounts and back to your point. So that's a bigger challenge. And I don't know what company is going to solve that. Is that going to be government? Is there going to be a company, Facebook, solving it? So what's your thought on that?
It's interesting because, I mean, there's it's tough because on one hand, I mean, you think about spam email, perfect example. So for those people that want to sign up for, you know, their 10% off coupon, you've got to hand over arguably a digital identity, an email, an address or something. So not everybody wants 25 different hundred companies worth of spam coming in. So what do? We set up a fake account or two. Well, you know, and so this just proliferates more and more and all. But it's not really a fake account. It's a legitimate account that I don't want anybody with my identity on it. So you end up with all of these spurious accounts that are out there. Then, I mean, you've only got to look at the scamming and the spamming and all the other sides of it. I mean, the ability to automate setting up accounts is huge. I mean, 3 billion accounts is not just, you know, regular growth. There's a lot of automation in there.
Right, and probably some of it government originated. And this kind of gets at this whole concept of disinformation or using fake accounts to, you know, plant information or to market a product or something like that so that they can make money or to plant some sort of ransomware generating type software.
Totally. I mean, it's counterintelligence at that point in time. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, we've only got to look at the election. I mean, let's go back to the last election, which I find hilarious. Yeah. You know, this is great. If you look, I think Wikipedia has it, and I actually validated it on about half a dozen other sources. There are over 100, and it's 100 and something, it's a large 100 number of elections that have been basically manipulated. United States is winning that. We are way ahead in being identified as manipulating a lot of elections. And now the tables have been turned. So, we're crying foul. I mean, seriously? What the hell?
So, Chris, I wanted to ask you a question about that. When I was in grad school, I did my thesis on Internet Access Management. During my research, I find that, forget this country, in Eastern Europe, is one of the most advanced...
Estonia.
Estonia.
I love it. So I've actually got a couple of good friends over there that are working on their systems.
Yes, and I was actually... I did a presentation at a cybersecurity conference in France last year. And the guy who's working on that project, I don't know, you might know him. I can't forget, he has a long name. And he and I were talking about what are they doing in terms of blockchain. And so what do you think of the future for electronic voting? Do you think that now Estonia is ahead in terms of electronic voting? That's going to push the United States, because it's on the cyberspace, to say, you know what, we want to be first in this as well. We want to play, you know, in this arena.
I think it's interesting. So I would hesitate to say that the United States would chase Estonia, because especially with our current regime, I don't think they consider them that way. Incorrectly, unfortunately, but I don't think they consider them that way. I mean, I love electronic voting. It's brilliant. It's like one person, one vote, which means I have all the votes if I use my exploits properly. I mean, I'm great. I got all the votes. I had no issues on that one at all. I don't see a problem in, like, my version of democracy.
Okay.
Now, in reality, we have over the last numerous years. I mean, I remember the debacle in Florida over Bush winning with the Diebold machines. I mean, that was an absolute mess. I've still got my cease and desist letter from that one. Oh yeah, we might have had some fun with those voting machines back then. So we're going back several elections.
Wow. I think the thing that we see is that the technology companies that make the voting software and machines are really behind the eight ball. And I'd like to see high-tech companies like Oracle, companies like Microsoft, really well-funded, innovative companies, try to get into that election space and have a product or a solution. And I just haven't seen it happen. Have you?
I think, from an operating system and architecture, I think it's there. But the support, to your point, is definitely not there. To me, it wouldn't be that. What I would love to, and actually, who the heck was it? It was Switzerland. Tried the right approach. Switzerland said, hey, we're going to do electronic voting. And they actually put their voting machines up for bug bounties. Didn't last long, but it was the best way of doing it. I mean, you've only got to look at like HackOne and BugCrowd and how they've changed the how you actually can basically almost crowdsource the attacking vectors. But to me, I think if you're going to come up and you're going to be like, hey, I want to trust one person, one vote, I think it needs to be like the open source community. It's like, I'm going to put it out there and you all get the chance to beat up on it. And when you've gotten to a stage where you've taken out, you know, most of the nasty stuff and you've debugged a chunk of it, then maybe we'll consider using it effectively. To your point, whether that's, you know, a Microsoft Oracle solution, whether that's a Linux-based solution or whatever the heck it is, if it's got a big company behind it, I mean, that would be it could be fantastic. Not sure I'd be very happy with Google voting machine.
Yeah.
That might scare me a little bit, to be honest.
You know, not necessarily saying that... In the United States, we have a long way to go in terms of electronic
voting. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, we're kindergarten level if that. I mean, we're not even kindergarten level. The fact that for 2 years running, and I think it'll probably be there again this year, but 2 years running, we've had the voting village at DEF CON. And on all occasions, and it's been very publicized, the systems that have been presented and the systems that have been used have been breached numerous times. By numerous people with varying levels of skills.
And I would say that's partly because of the creativity that that conference facilitates and the people there that are very creative. And this kind of gets at another problem, which is a lot of these standardized tests or these traditional ways of thinking a security professional career path should roll out squashes creativity. You want to have creativity, and you're definitely creative. But how do we... So the question is, how do we get more creativity and security to come up with better solutions? Because I find a lot of times it's lacking.
So for me, I would say as security professionals, we need to talk a lot more effectively with the likes of HR. So we literally need to buddy up really closely and really carefully with HR. We blame HR a lot for being the gatekeepers. But I'd argue that we're not doing probably the best job we possibly could at helping HR understand kind of who we are. I mean, tell me the last time somebody brought an HR person along to like a BurCon or a GurCon or a DEFCON to show here's who we are.
So, Chris, that's actually a good point. And like I say, in the IAM space, our duty is to make sure people have the right access. People have the right access. When they move, we have to make sure to remove their access away. But in the same token, we're not educating people, right? And back to your point, is like you have to educate what is human resources, what is accounting department. You have to educate these people about the importance of the access, you know. And and I guess but to your point, we're not doing a good job. You know, we are kind of in our own bubble, and we want people to understand our lingo. We want people to, you know, and we should.
And that's the thing. We want people to understand how we operate, as opposed to coming to them with open hands and going, how can we help you? Different conflict.
I think the HR people don't understand that it's okay to accept a guy who's got a purple beard. Because a lot of times, the HR people think, you know, there's something wrong with you. You're violating dress code. You just don't fit in. And they don't realize that actually you're solving, you know, huge, huge problems. And the problem with the HR people or the traditional bureaucrats or the traditional managers, and I'm not knocking them, but I sort of am, because they're not open a lot of times to somebody like you unless they know you and have worked with you.
And to some degree, that's on me. To work out, again, this goes back to the talk I gave on the dogs. You know, when you approach an animal, both of you have to work out the rules of engagement. And sometimes those rules of engagement are that you circle around each other for a while and you figure it out. And eventually, maybe it's a piece of ham or in one of my dogs' case, it's a twiglet that figures it out. But it's something that then breaks that barrier down so that the pair of you can actually have productive conversations.
Is there a go-between person oftentimes? When you're interacting with CISOs and senior technology leaders, what's that like?
For the most part, it's very, very constructive. Once they've actually, and again, this comes back to, I mean, you know, we have, we all bring different challenges to the table. For me, it's a purple beard and, you know, Vibrams. For others, there's color. There might be orientation. There might be religion. There, you name it, it might be physical. It might not be physical. And so what we have to do is try to teach people to look beyond what they first see. And that's a human thing. That's not a tech thing. That's a totally human thing.
Absolutely. Well said. I mean, I've dealt with that in my life personally.
Yeah.
But let's move on to another topic here. That really is going to be this concept. There's no silver bullet in cyber defense. And I know a lot of times you talk about defense from the attacker's perspective. And I think the talk that you gave last year at Cybersecurity Summit, you mentioned the importance of really gaining adversary intelligence and the attacker's perspective. What's your advice for this community in 2019? Again, we have Chris Roberts here. We're in Minneapolis in the Convention Center. We're just recapping some cybersecurity best practices from the BerCon conference. Also present is Mamadi Kona, who is an identity and access management specialist in the healthcare space. But back to you, Chris.
You know, it's. I think there are a couple of different things. I'll give MITRE some. So, it's tough. We talk about frameworks, but as an attacker, we don't always use frameworks. But if we take a step back and go, what's a simple, easy, common denominator? MITRE has done some fantastic work at putting like the attack framework together. It really hones in a very recognizable set of steps as to how an attack takes place, everything from initial recon all the way through to exfiltration. On one hand, I can't thank it enough. On the other hand, you know, the caveat is, hey, we're attackers. We will use whatever capabilities and tools are available, and they might not follow that framework. But at least for a baseline understanding, something like that has done, they've done a really, really nice job at it. So it's, there is arguably no excuse to not know how a standardized attack is likely to occur.
And the cyber kill chain is another one that's, would you say that's similar to the
Yeah, I mean, MITRE? Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you look at the Lockheed kill chain, and actually IBM X-Force has got a really, really nice one out as well. They've done another nice job on theirs. There's a couple of really good ones, like three or four really, really nice ones where they've actually gone down and said, look, you know, this is typically how an attack works. But the flip side is, you know, from a blue teaming and an adversarial research standpoint, some of the biggest challenges I have is, you know, you can go out and gather all of the pieces of intelligence you want. You can go figure out that you are targeted by, you know, the guys down in maybe Brazil and a couple of teams operating out of the Ukraine and whatever else. But if you haven't fixed some of the fundamental stuff inside your environment, why are you even chasing down those rabbit holes?
Because you've got lower fruit that you could fix.
Oh my gosh, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, the simple stuff.
So, and back to your point, so how do you think about the dynamic of auditors and then organizations? And back to your point, though, they have these problems going on, and they're aware of it.
And I gotta say, Chris, you don't exactly fit the typical auditor persona. Because I interact with auditors, and I'm in meetings with auditors, and I know what they're like. They're
Sorry for them. I actually, I feel sorry. And it's an empathy. Maybe it's an empathy. I feel empathy for an auditor, for the most part. Because if you think about it, their job is to help an organization understand risk.
That's right.
They're not there to, they're not, but they are in such potentially a combative situation, especially if they're coming in on like PCI or HIPAA or FERC or something. The organization's immediately on its guard. They put the auditor in a room, they hide as much as they possibly can, and they won't let them out for bloody lunch or toilet breaks unless they make them pass the bloody, you know, it's, I feel bad for them. We should be welcoming them in and going, help us understand our risks.
So then I see a lot of checkbox security during those times. It's like, oh, check, and which is now happening, you know, the security community, or, you know, too much.
We've got the checkbox security. Mm-hmm. You know, it's pen testing puppy mills and checkbox security. Mm-hmm. And between those two, that's part of the reason mm-hmm. why we're in such a mess. You know, that's part of the reason why so often the breach in, you know, retail or healthcare or mm-hmm. whatever, where they're like, well, we passed our audit. Well, mm-hmm. congratulations, you managed to fool the auditor mm-hmm. into putting a check in that box. You also fooled yourself.
That's right, yeah.
And you did an entire disservice to the organization that writes you a paycheck. Yeah.
You can't say that in a meeting unless you're Chris Roberts.
Otherwise, you won't get your next paycheck.
Yes. I you're so right.
Yeah.
You're so right.
Your own point.
And I work a lot with auditors, and I totally value the input and the questions that they ask because they're being evaluated on doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, especially, I mean, you look at – so PCI is a perfect example. You know, there's now punitive damages against the auditing company. So now what you've done is you've got the auditing company is now playing absolute cat and mouse with the flipping company that they're trying to audit in the first place. So auditing, I mean, it's a ridiculous scenario we've set up for ourselves.
Wow. What inspires you, Chris? I mean, you've just got this storied career, you know, you travel speaking. What inspires and motivates you to, you know, stop the next attack?
For me, I'm still interested and I'm still amazed by how things work and why things work mm-hmm. and what happens. Mm-hmm. All the way through till, you know, I'm still rereading, you know, like just some basic physics books and other things. And some of the stuff I'm messing around with nanotechnology and bio-nanotech, I'm rereading all of my books going back to like chemical biology and all that kind of stuff. I mean, for me, it's just that continual interest. What makes things tick? And honestly, it's that thirst for knowledge, I think, as well. I'm very fortunate, you know, with the crew over at Ativo that I can kind of throw the crystal ball out 5 or 10 years and go, what's it going to be like? And then hopefully, you know, help influence it in some ways.
Do you know Jason Livingston from Ativo?
Yeah.
Okay. He was a classmate of mine during grad school.
Oh, no way. Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic.
Yes. He's another thought leader in a different way, but still in security for sure. But I want to throw a different question out there. And this really is dealing with the IoT connected devices and sort of the growth of IoT. And, you know, I've got my smartphone here. I see you've got one. I know, Mamadi, you've got one. But I think we want so much convenience. You know, I just went in and I deleted a bunch of apps from my phone that it gave permissions. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of weighing, well, this one actually is pretty cool because it gives me this. This one's cool because it gives me that. And I'm trying to figure out which ones do I really want. And then I probably deleted 15 of them. But there's a growth of these permissions that we're becoming socially cultured to give. We just say, yes, give this app permission. And that includes the IoT-connected microwave, mm-hmm. refrigerator, you know, the Google Home, and all these other devices. What are your thoughts on how to best secure IoT-connected devices?
Ooh, that's going to be a rough one because, I mean, it's not the growth. It's a tsunami of IoT devices coming down at us. We're, I think the projections are around the 26 billion mark by the end of 2020. And that number's fairly variable as well, but it's a ridiculous number of devices. And you're absolutely spot on. We have taken convenience over safety and security. Mm-hmm. I think and it's tough because, I mean, there's so many different areas we need to look at. I think we do need to take a step back and go and start questioning things. It's like, okay, why do I need this? Why do I want it? Why do I have to have it? Well, the challenge is, back to your point, is convenience. Mm-hmm. And as security people, I mean, the best we can do at the moment is honestly try to figure out how to fix it. It's no use breaking anything anymore. We know it can all be broken. The challenge we have is fixing it. And the question is where do we fix it? Is it manufacturing related? Mm-hmm. Is it regulatory related? Is it software?
I'm going to interrupt there and say, I don't think it's regulatory at all.
No,
I don't think you can regulate.
No.
Part of the, you know, I've talked to legislators, and I know, Mamadi, you're well connected with the government leaders, but the legislators are so far behind the technology. Absolutely. There may be one or two elected leaders who actually can hold a candle to these technology topics, and that's a problem.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
So, Chris, can I make a joke here? So, does that mean that instead of public servants going to law schools or taking political science, they have to start, going to STEM,
almost taking STEM classes
and all of that, so they can understand better technology? So.
But it's tough on this one. So, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, I always use my mother as a yardstick. So at home, at the house, I've got, numerous cameras, numerous mesh networks for all the security stuff. I run 5 different wireless networks and a bunch of other stuff. And I've got, PF Sense in the house and Greylog and a bunch of other things because I've set it up that way. My mother wouldn't stand the snowball's chance in hell of setting it up, let alone patching the damn stuff every 5 minutes. So we somehow or other have to make it much more effective and efficient and safer right off the bat. This can't be we put it out and we keep patching it every 6 months until the company gets sold, at which point we forget about it.
I often say to people about the security dilemma problem, I say it's going to get to a point where we're going to have some innovative breakthrough. It's going to get it to another level. I don't know what it's going to be. We had that in medicine several times with penicillin or in open heart surgery. And what do you think it's going to take for that next innovative leap? And what is the context of the innovative leap going to be in?
So I'll be pretty blunt. We're going to have to kill people. A lot of people.
Say more.
A lot of people. We'll have to kill people. Here's why. As humans, we're not good at change unless it's forced upon us. Otherwise, guess what? We'd be a heck of a lot safer and we wouldn't click on everything that comes underneath our nose. Think about it as a kid. When you grew up, you were told, don't touch the stove, it's hot. Don't touch the kettle, it boils. What did you do? Touch the damn stove and touch the kettle. We had to experience it. So from a safety and a security standpoint, if I keep telling you, don't click on something, do something, you typically don't do it until it harms you.
Bruce Schneider has a book out called Click Here to Kill Everybody. And it kind of reminds me of what you're saying.
I have the book, actually.
I've talked to him. So what you're saying is, if I'm understanding it right, and correct me if I'm wrong, but what you're saying is, unfortunately, there may be a bad event where people die and it opens our eyes, and that is the catalyst for innovation. And that innovation has come out of conflict in the past.
Innovation typically comes out of conflict, unfortunately, But here's the challenge. It can't be one or two people. I mean, I hate to bring this up, but you think about school shootings. Okay, how many kids do we have to lose before we do something effective? Apparently, it's not 20 or 30 at a time. Somebody's literally going to have to nuke a couple of schools before we go, hey, maybe we should do something different. And that's, again, so I went through the same thing, and we'll touch briefly on it. Obviously, I've messed around with a lot of transportation. I asked the question once, how many of these vehicles would I actually have to get rid of, demolish or crash before you would pay attention? And there's a number. And it's crazy that we think that way, but we do. And I think I don't think it'll come to this, but I think it's the only way that we're going to learn is, we're pacemakers. When, 4 or 5 years ago, when it started to become clear that we could influence pacemakers, the question was asked, how many people do you want us to drop dead before you'll actually pay attention?
Wow.
Yeah. But I mean, think about it. Tell me a different way. Give me another alternative for us as humans to learn change effectively.
And Chris, also, with the security arena being noisy these days, does not help. And everyone is telling you, we have this can fix this and all of that. So that even add more to the problem, to the existing problem, that one.
We're our own worst enemy. I mean, so I did a fairly lengthy piece on the RSA conference earlier this year in San Francisco. And it went over 250,000 hits.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Yeah. We're going to have to maybe link to that. Yeah, that link that out.
And it was ridiculous because I pointed out that our industry has become a circus.
Yeah.
you know, we are led by marketing, mm-hmm. and marketing's message is we need to make security easy.
Yeah.
How many LinkedIn know-nothing people try to talk to you, Chris? Because I know you get a lot, and I get some, but you probably get a lot more than I do.
I get a lot of people. It's, you know what, I'm as respectful as I can be. It's I have a, for whatever reason, I've got this innate need to be able to make sure I respond to everybody. Mm-hmm. So it takes a while.
good.
Yeah, LinkedIn gets busy, but for me, I have a lot of respect. I actually have a lot of time for LinkedIn, as mm-hmm. much as it drives me nuts. What I do mm-hmm. like about it is you have to have a fairly complete profile.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Right.
So
right.
unlike yeah. Twitter, where again we talk about humans, mm-hmm. unlike Twitter, I can put a fake profile up, mm-hmm. and I can anonymously abuse you and call you an idiot or yep. fool, sure. whatever it might be, insult. On LinkedIn, you've actually got to go to a lot more length to be able to do that. So I have a little bit more respect for it because I can have much more human conversations.
So, but Chris, I would like to ask you, so what do you think about what steps? Because when it comes to education nowadays, the government is not catching up with reality, right? If the government knew what was going to be relevant, you know, 20 years from now, we'll probably have a lot of security professionals, but the government is really lagging behind. But what do you think that the step that, you know, society or the government needs to take in order to prepare the next generation of cybersecurity professional? Because for me, I'm a mentor. I mentor high school students, and then I go, you know, to high school and I talk about, you know, about security. So what do you think? Do we need to do more of that, or what are your thoughts on that?
So I had a really good conversation with somebody today about yes. that, and I've actually had other really good conversations. We're starting too late. Mm-hmm. To your point, mm-hmm. into high school is mm-hmm. great, mm-hmm. but those kids have had devices in their hands for a number of years.
Yes.
They have profiles, mm-hmm. they have habits, they have forms, they listen to parents, whatever it might be, they have their ways of doing things, and now you have to change mm-hmm. rather than educate from a blank piece of paper or greenfield site, whichever way you want to look at it. Mm-hmm. You know, if we were able to get into the early stages, like the early Ks mm-hmm. on that kind of stuff, like, you know, grades 5, 6, 7, 8 stuff, mm-hmm. and start to help them understand good citizenship online.
Sure.
And all the other things that we know mm-hmm. that we need to do to educate our charges, mm-hmm. we do that to the kids. I think that would make immeasurable amounts of difference.
The gaming community comes to mind as a community that has a lot of potential. I think of gaming when I grew up. I gamed. Mm-hmm. I did the Nintendo and then the Sega Genesis and, you know, then some computer games. But the really enthusiastic gamers turn into hackers mm-hmm. because they want to win the game. Mm-hmm. And they're able to figure out a way mm-hmm. to win the game.
Sure.
And so I think those people, if they are given a catalyst to learn coding early on mm-hmm. at the, you know, second grade level, they learn the code that's running the game, and they might find that cool. I just don't see enough of that.
Yeah. I think it's probably not just code. I think there's all sorts of things. It's use. It's basic usage. I mean, my daughter's been given a Google mm-hmm. Google Chromebook thing, mm-hmm. but has been given minimal instruction on keeping herself safe.
Sure. And back to your point, like when I think of security, it's not necessarily knowing how to code. It's a mindset. I remember when I was going to my police training, like every time now, it's kind of second habit for me. I get into a room, the first thing that I look for is the exit.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not necessary to train all our kids, the new generation, but it's, you know, to learn how to code, but it's to train them that mindset of security, you know, that cybersecurity vision, you know.
So I'll take it a slightly different tact, same concept, but mm-hmm. slightly different tact. Here's a question for the both of you. Mm-hmm. Can you measure and quantify security?
Highly subjective. I mean, you got to compare it against something else.
But can you measure security, or are you measuring mm-hmm. risk or safety?
Well, at the ultimate level, if people die, that's definitely proof of insecurity.
That's safety. Mm-hmm. At that point, that's a safety, so that's mm-hmm. OT. So here's a different way of looking at it. You mm-hmm. think, I mean, you go back to human evolution times. Mm-hmm. When we stuck our head out of the caves, mm-hmm. We were typically getting swiped at and eaten by things with large teeth. Mm-hmm. Didn't care about security. We cared about safety.
Yeah.
You think about this day and age. Mm-hmm. How many people, even in this day and age, have to worry about their safety on a daily basis? Back to race, color, creed, religion, orientation, location. Take your pick. It's a safety conversation, not security.
Wow.
we understand as wow. humans, yeah. fundamentally, we understand safety.
Yeah. Right. Watch before you cross the road.
Yeah.
yeah. yeah.
Don't
yeah.
talk yeah. to strangers should, yeah. and all yeah. those yeah. mantras that you
like your parents. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Same. Yeah. Same thing. So you add that you take those basics sure. and you add in our realms worth of those basics, and now it just becomes fundamental learning from K upwards.
Wow. I mean, you cannot say better than that. I mean, that's thank spot on.
So one other topic here, and that is ransomware. It seems like it's been on the rise. It's gotten better. And if you're a mid-sized company, you know, and you're paying $5,000 or $10,000 through Bitcoin, and then you get your data back, versus hiring a consultant like you, which would be a lot more. I mean, how does a company deal with this concept of ransomware?
Pay the money. Totally anti-FBI advice for you. Pay the ransom.
In what conditions? Because I know that may be conditional, right?
It typically is, yeah. I'll speak from experience. I've helped a number of companies mm-hmm. through this, mm-hmm. and we sat down and, you know, we've done a lot of incident response on this. And in one case, we were very fortunate mm-hmm. that the organization, every single one of the computers had mm-hmm. been encrypted using the same key. And we were like, mm-hmm. yay! And I think they wanted, it was like, a quarter of a Bitcoin. I'm like, pay the bloody ransom, because two things will happen. Either number one, we'll get a key that works and we can get stuff back, or secondly, you've wasted maybe an hour of my time mm-hmm. and you sure. won't get a key, and then we know exactly where we are. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Now, where that money goes, what happens to that money, mm-hmm. you know, that's where our friendly federal friends will come in and tell you all the nasty stuff, which absolutely I agree. Mm-hmm. But if the company's backups are sitting on the same server as the company's production system mm-hmm. and they don't have backup tapes offsite and their incident response plan's got 4 inches of dust on it, you don't have a flipping option.
Right. Mamni, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it depends on the situation, because what I think about, so you have a ransomware situation, the guy comes to you, hey, I am encrypting your data. So how do you even know that that's the right guy to begin with? How do you even know if you decided to pay this guy, how do you know that you're going to get,
you don't.
So you find yourself in that.
But in essence, so here's my counter to that one. Mm-hmm. You actually, in most cases, not all, mm-hmm. in a lot of cases, you do know, because it's a business.
Sure.
It is a business.
If mm-hmm. I don't mm-hmm. give you your data back, mm-hmm. word will get out and nobody else will pay me. But right. if I give you, it's mm-hmm. the Silk Road. Mm-hmm. I mean, you go back several thousand years mm-hmm. when the caravans went across the desert,
sure.
they didn't kill the camel drivers. They dunked them on the head and they took a percentage away from them. But they let them live mm-hmm. because they knew damn well in 6 months' time they'd be coming back and they could harvest from them again.
So, Chris, that's my point, though. If you get paid them that money, so what's the guarantee that they're not going to keep coming back?
Well, you better get your shit fixed. I mean, that's literally it. I mean, now you've bought yourself
okay.
6 months of grace mm-hmm. to get somebody in to do full forensics, do sure. all the cleanup and everything else, and get yourself protected. Or at least better, get yourself off the bottom rung of the ladder. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
That would be my attitude on that.
Chris Roberts, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Thanks for being in Minnesota to support the Burcon Conference. Mamadi, mm-hmm. thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Let's get to final comments. What is your advice, or what do you see the future of the security community holding for the next couple of years?
I put it as a very human voice. I mean, the talk today I gave was very much about us taking care of ourselves. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that it extends to us looking to the next generation. To your point, Mamadi, mm-hmm. you know, do we look at the K-12 generation mm-hmm. and how can we help influence them?
Sure.
And then also helping business understand, you know, as an asset, the humans that are in front of them, not just mm-hmm. us, but also the rest of the population, mm-hmm. has to be part of the solution.
And I think that infers entrepreneurs and startups. I think the more companies starting up and competing, small, some of them will fail, sure, a lot of them will probably, but if the more competitors we have, the more likely I think we're going to be able to flesh out innovation. And I think that's what we need, is we need innovation. We need companies like Ativo Networks. Mm-hmm. We need companies of all sizes to hopefully innovate in this space. Mamadi, what do you think?
Yeah, I think Chris kind of mentioned that at the beginning. So is also, as an organization, we have to try to look behind beer or look or accent. And because I get to the meeting, I'm like, oh, I don't understand that. Well, people already have made up their mind about, you know what I'm going to say. Chris mentioned that. I think that's going to be very, 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 very helpful.
That's a hard one. I hear you and I know it well. And I think the more influence you get, the more credibility you're going to have overcoming that.
Sure.
And people still have their biases. I've seen it in all kinds of organizations. But this has just been so great for you to be here and to share your thoughts.
I'd appreciate it. Thank you for the time. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's been fun.
Well, I got to say one thing. Imagine there's an incident and you got a war room set up, right? And it's a major incident and it's a war room set up and you got 20 people. What do you think is better? 20 people that are all like each other and that all have the KPMG PwC path and they all wear the same suit and tie and they go to the same bars and they drive the same BMWs with loans on them. No, you bring those types of people in the room and you're going to get crap results. You bring in a wide array, spectrum of people from different countries, different company paths, college, non-college, and I'll just say, there's people went to college, know a lot, plenty, don't know anything.
I challenged everybody last week at a conference. I gave them two challenges. I'm like, number one, next conference you go to, bring somebody with you who is not in our industry.
I like that.
And it's been interesting. I took somebody with me along to a conference this week on the, and I said, my other challenge to you is when you turn around to me and tell me there aren't enough people in this industry, tell me that you've gone down to the unemployment office and you've talked as a human to another person who's maybe a pipe fitter or a shop floor worker or a manufacturing person, and you haven't given them the time of day and a potential opportunity of this industry. If you haven't done that, you're not out of people. You're just not looking in the right place.
It's because people who have power like to put people like them around them. That's a human bias going back to the beginning of time.
But I think there's this saying that we tend to go alone in order to get along because no one wants to rock the boat. So if I'm in a leadership position, I want to stay there for a long time. I don't think people tend to hire people that think like them because they want to keep that,
Enron did that, right? What happened to them?
There's a really good book out there that's well worth reading. It's I can't remember the bloody name of it. It's Seats on the Bus. It's like the people being in the right seat on the right bus. I'm gonna have to find it. I'll have to let you know what it was.
Please do.
Yeah.
What type of music or dance or art inspires you? Are you at all connected with the art community? Tell me more about that.
My art connection is probably vicariously through the likes of Eddie Mize. He's our world. He's basically brother from another mother. He's amazing. From an art standpoint, from a music standpoint, I listen to music. And it will depend entirely upon what I'm doing. Will depend entirely upon what type of music I'm listening to. If I'm coding or if I'm writing reports or if I'm doing assessment stuff, I listen to very, very different music.
Today is Prince's birthday and you got a purple beard. And we're in Minneapolis. I think there's a connection there. You're a Prince fan, aren't you?
Quite possibly.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
We are out.